Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio-231, and it's November 6th, and so it's a Wednesday. So don't forget, we're having practicums this week, and there's one more class that needs to take a practicum at 1:30 today. And then I'll release the grades really quick. All right, so we said today is November 6th. Yeah, we're gonna get into heart. We're gonna finish up endocrine chapter and get into heart. And the endocrine system is the last chapter you're responsible for the exam coming up. And that exam is when? Is it a week from today?
Yes.
I would say yes, but it is not. So I can't say yes because... Oh, no, you're right. I was thinking it is Monday. Okay? I thought it was Monday, but it's not. It's Wednesday. It is exactly 1 week from today. One week from today. But don't forget, the next class meeting on Monday, November 11th, is Veterans Day. Campus is closed. All right, so we can't have an exam that day, but we will have it a week from today. Chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, but not the heart. Heart will be on the last exam. Exam number 4 is not cumulative. It's not over everything in the class, just the last chapters that we look at. Okay? So that's good. But of course, everything in these chapters is important, and you don't want to forget any of it anyway, especially when you get into physiology, because we don't have time in physiology to review anatomy very much, except maybe in lab, for instance. But that's about it. Plus, if you do any kind of clinical work, you'll want to know all this anatomy anyway, but then you'll start using it, and you'll never forget it by then. All right, so last time, we did start endocrine system. Oh, another important announcement. Right here. All right, this is really important because this is on the test. All right, so this is on the test, you guys. Here is an announcement I put in Blackboard, plus an email I sent to everybody, and it tells you where you can find the answers, right, or the answer keys to the end-of-chapter questions. They are in the appendix, but somehow the publisher got these mixed up because they added a chapter. They added chapter 17, which is endocrine system, and they forgot to rearrange where they put the answer keys in Appendix B. So the answers to chapter 17, which I think is endocrinology, is you can find that at chapter 25 in the appendix. All right, and then chapter 18, the end-of-chapter questions you can find in chapter 17 in the appendix. And then it just kind of wraps around like that. So here is your little another key for you to see where the answer keys are. Okay, so this is in Blackboard. You have it as an email, and I think it's pretty easy to follow after that. All right, so that's a pretty important announcement, especially for the last part of the class. All right, so endocrine system. Let's see, what were we talking about? Well, okay, let's compare this with the nervous system. Nervous system is what? Very fast, but the duration of action is very short. So if you want something to contract the skeletal muscle, you don't want to wait around for a week or two for that muscle to contract. Your nervous system will send a signal for that muscle to contract very rapidly, but it won't stay contracted for a long period of time. It's gonna relax unless your brain sends another signal down to it to stay contracted, right? So nervous system is fast but short duration. And so you need a control system that will manage your body or coordinate your body over the long term, and that is the endocrine system, right? And endocrine system doesn't work fast like the nervous system. It takes a little while to have its effects manifest, but the duration of action is nice and long. So that's something that compares nervous system with endocrine system. Endocrine system relies on things we call hormones, right? And where does a hormone come from? Where does a hormone come from? Trying to figure out where we are. Maybe we're starting with thyroid gland. Maybe we'll review posterior. But where does it come from? Where does that hormone come from? I think that's what I was asking. It comes from an endocrine gland, right? And so what other kinds of glands are there? There are exocrine glands, right, that have a duct. So endocrine glands have no duct. And so that leads us into the next question. Well, then how do these hormones get around in your body? Because they should go everywhere in your body. Yeah, they get picked up by a capillary. They enter the blood, and blood delivers them everywhere. right? And then they can diffuse out of another capillary in a distant tissue, and that tissue could be a target tissue if it has what? A receptor for that particular hormone. Otherwise, that tissue will completely ignore that hormone, won't even know that it's there. All right, so that kind of is the endocrine system in general, and what a hormone is, and some necessary components like receptors. And if a target tissue has a receptor, when a hormone binds to that receptor, it's going to change the physiology of that target tissue. And so we say it elicits a specific response in that target tissue. All right, so last time, I think we did look at pituitary gland. Right here, remember, pituitary gland has these two divisions. It has the neural hypothesis, which is the posterior lobe. It has the adenoid hypothesis, which is the anterior lobe. We say adeno for the anterior lobe because adeno means glandular tissue. And this anterior pituitary does originate from epithelium, right, during development and becomes a gland that can synthesize hormones and secrete hormones. So the anterior pituitary can do both, synthesize and secrete. The posterior pituitary really is an extension of the brain, so it's not epithelium, it's nervous tissue. And the posterior pituitary cannot synthesize hormones. It can release hormones, or something that we might consider a hormone. We might want to consider it a neurohormone because it's actually coming from a part of the brain, right? But if it can't synthesize those hormones, where do they come from? If it can secrete a hormone, if the posterior pituitary can secrete a hormone, where do they come from? They come from the hypothalamus. That's right. So there are nerve cell bodies in the hypothalamus that synthesize those hormones, and then they're transported down through axons to the axon terminus in the posterior pituitary. And when an electrical signal goes down that axon to the axon terminus, then that particular nerve cell will release that hormone, which goes where? It's not on this slide, but where does that hormone go then? Into the blood, right? Because it's a hormone. So you could think of that compound that's being released by that neuron in the posterior pituitary as a neurotransmitter, right? Because it comes from a neuron, but you should also consider it a hormone because it gets distributed by the vascular system. So it has characteristics of both. That's why we would like to call those things neurohormones. All right, and for the posterior pituitary, how many of these neurohormones are released? There's only two, right? They are oxytocin and ADH, antidiuretic hormone. And should we go over that? Did we go over that last time? I think, yeah. So oxytocin is a powerful smooth muscle stimulant, causes contraction of smooth muscle for parturition, the uterus is smooth muscle, as well as the milk letdown reflex. All right, for nursing an infant. All right, so that's going to take us to the thyroid gland. How are we doing on the thyroid gland? Did we talk much about it?
No.
Okay. Okay, so we have some nice pictures. That's really good. It's even better. All right. Okay, so here is an illustration, anterior view of your neck, and you're very familiar with the thyroid cartilage. We're going to look at that when we get to the respiratory system. But the reason why you're familiar with it, because at least in males, it sticks out. It's very prominent. Right? That's the thyroid cartilage. Sometimes we call that the voice box because inside of that are vocal cords. And just below this thyroid cartilage is the thyroid gland. And you can see it kind of looks like a butterfly. Part of it does exist anteriorly. Most of it is lateral. There is not very much that's posterior. Right, so this is the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland secretes thyroid hormone, or thyroxine, which adjusts basal metabolic rate everywhere in your body, but it also aids in development. So somebody that is devoid of thyroid hormone, right? And I see thyroid hormone right here on the word slide. We have a couple different forms of thyroid hormone. There's something called T3 and T4. All right, but if a person that's developing doesn't have thyroid hormone, then they won't develop properly, especially the nervous system. The nervous system just won't develop without proper thyroid hormone. So it regulates metabolism, but also supports development. Okay, so T3 and T4, I don't even think you have to know what these things are. It might mention it in the book, but these are thyroid hormones, And the three stands for, it has three iodine molecules attached to it. And if it's T4, it has four iodine molecules attached to it. And in order for it to have potency or efficacy, the iodine has to be on those hormones. If it's missing, right, then even though the thyroid gland is producing something that's very similar to thyroid hormone, it won't have the proper activity. Right. And under those circumstances, right, there's no feedback to the pituitary gland. Usually, if the thyroid gland is producing thyroid hormone that's built properly, it gets into the blood, goes back to the anterior pituitary, and it tells the anterior pituitary, well, the levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone are proper, and then the anterior pituitary will cut back on the secretion of thyroid-stimulating hormone, and therefore it will maintain just a constant and appropriate level of T3 and T4 in the blood. But if T3 and T4 aren't being made, then the anterior pituitary, in a sense, gets very worried about that, and it releases even more thyroid-stimulating hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland, and it causes the thyroid gland to grow, right, because the rest of your body thinks that there's no thyroid hormone. So the thyroid grows and produces more of this thyroid hormone that does not have iodine on it. Right. And so the thyroid gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And people with that abnormality, you can see their thyroid gland because it like hangs off of their neck, right? And we call that goiter. And goiter can be treated pretty easily, right, if indeed it is a goiter, by just a dietary supplement. And you could guess what that dietary supplement would be. Would be iodine, right? And then the thyroid gland can make thyroid hormone with those iodine molecules on it, and then the feedback mechanism will then take this thyroid gland back to its original size. All right, so here we see the thyroid gland. We see the thyroid gland has a bunch of these circular structures. We call that a follicle. There are a couple of places in your body that have follicles, and the cells that ring the follicle or make the follicle up, I only see a single layer right here. That's the part of the tissue that takes iodine from the blood and puts it into the center part of the follicle. Sometimes we call that the antrum. It also takes up amino acids, right, and combines those amino acids and iodine to make thyroid hormone T3 and T4, and it's stored in the follicle until it gets a signal to secrete it. And that signal is thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary. All right. If we look around to the posterior side of the thyroid gland, okay, I can see four little nodules right here. That's another kind of endocrine gland embedded in the thyroid gland, and these are called the parathyroid glands because what they're on either side of the thyroid gland, and they're important. They secrete parathyroid hormone. Right, and parathyroid hormone increases the concentration of calcium that's in the blood. And why do you need calcium ions in your body? What have we learned about calcium ions so far in here? Why do you need calcium? For bones, to make bones strong. Any other reason for calcium? Muscle contraction. That's right. You need calcium ions for muscle contraction. And there's another important thing, which I'm sure we looked at, because we're already through the nervous system. And it's important for synaptic transmission. All right, so in order for neurons to communicate with each other through a synapse, via a chemical synapse, calcium has to be present. And when it enters that axon terminus, it causes release of neurotransmitter from an axon terminus. So without proper levels of calcium in the blood, your muscles won't contract. What's maybe your favorite muscle? Heart, that's right. Heart won't contract, right? Can't live very long without the heart contracting. Skeletal muscles won't contract. Cardiac muscle, it makes up the heart. That's one kind of muscle. But what's your favorite skeletal muscle? You might say your diaphragm. Yeah, so you're thinking along my lines too, because your diaphragm is necessary for inspiration, right, for breathing. And of course, you all know breathing is really good. Can't do that without proper levels of calcium. All right, so if you had a choice with calcium, if there's a limited supply of calcium, where would you put it if you were your body? Would you put it in skeletal muscle like your diaphragm so you can breathe? Would you put it in your brain so that your brain can function? Or would you put it in bones to make bones strong? Brain, muscle probably would be my first two. The last place I would be considering would be what? Bones. And indeed, your body makes that decision for you, which then, sometimes, what does that produce in people? Osteoporosis. Indeed. Okay. Well, I need a drink. Okay, I'll be right back. Okay, so parathyroid hormone comes from these parathyroid glands when blood calcium is low. Okay, so where does your body get these calcium ions from then when blood calcium is low? It gets it from bone. So bone really is a reservoir of calcium. And then you should know what kind of cells break bone down. Osteoclasts, right? So parathyroid hormone increases the activity of osteoclasts, and that breaks breaks bone down, releases calcium, and probably also some phosphate, and that increases blood calcium levels. Parathyroid hormone also works on the kidney so that it takes calcium out of a fluid that we call filtrate, which will be urine. It takes calcium out of that filtrate and puts it back on in your body. And also it helps the absorption of calcium from your digestive tract. Because remember, calcium your body can't make, you have to have a dietary source for it. So you have to absorb it from your gastrointestinal tract. That's the job of the parathyroid glands. Okay. In between the follicles of the thyroid gland, there is another endocrine gland, okay, that secretes a hormone that has to do with calcium metabolism as well. All right, and so what do you know about control mechanisms in your body? If you should have precise control and balance over something, should you have maybe one input, one kind of control mechanism, or should there be two kinds of control mechanisms, and what's the relationship between them? That's right, they should be antagonistic to each other. All right, so the other hormone is called calcitonin. Calcitonin is antagonistic to the parathyroid hormone. So calcitonin decreases blood calcium concentration and takes calcium that's in the blood so that bone can get stronger. It incorporates it into bone, and it helps excrete calcium in the urine when blood calcium is too high. So that's antagonistic. And again, that is all within the thyroid gland right here. Calcitonin and parathyroid hormone are antagonistic to each other. Okay, that takes us to another endocrine gland, and that is the adrenal gland. Here is a kidney. Kidneys are kind of in your back, but sort of in your abdominal cavity. When we get to urinary system, you'll see exactly where they are, but you can get a sense of where they are. And on top of the kidneys is the adrenal gland. And when you look at this adrenal gland, does it look like it's homogeneous, or do you see some structures inside of it? I see some structures, right? It's just not all the same color, right? So this adrenal gland has a superficial region and a deep region. And you should remember what a superficial region of an organ is called. The cortex, right? And the deep part is called the medulla. Okay, so I see that right here. So here's the medulla. The deep part kind of looks darker to me. And here's the cortex on the outside. We talked about the medulla already because there are sympathetic nerve fibers that go to the medulla. And when nerve impulses reach the medulla secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine, right? Which is like a sympathetic neurotransmitter, but it goes in the blood and produces sympathetic response everywhere in your body. That's the medulla. We talked about that in the autonomic nervous system. What we haven't talked about yet is the cortex, right? And the cortex secretes a couple hormones. Okay, and the adrenal cortex is maintained by another hormone from the anterior pituitary. It's called ACTH, or adrenal corticotropic hormone. So ACTH from the anterior pituitary gets into the blood, goes everywhere, and the adrenal cortex is a target tissue, which means it has receptors for ACTH, And when that binds, it causes the adrenal cortex to grow, but also secrete its hormones. Right? And the hormones are, there's two classes of hormones from the adrenal cortex. There are things called mineralocorticoids, right? And these adjust sodium and potassium inside your body, which are minerals. Sodium and potassium are ions very similar to calcium, and you need proper levels of those ions for all kinds of things. A good example of a mineralocorticoid, aldosterone. Good, I'm glad I have that on the slide. Aldosterone, right, is a mineralocorticoid. It helps to maintain blood pressure, right, because when you eat salt, aldosterone helps your body hold on to that salt so that you don't lose it in urine. And when you retain salt, that helps you retain fluids, and that just maintains your blood pressure. Okay, I guess think of the tire on your car. And if you want to increase the pressure inside that tire, okay, what should you do with air? Should you put air in or take air out? Right? If the pressure is low when your car is sitting on it, then the tire kind of looks flat, right? And so to get the proper pressure, what do you have to do? You got to pump some air in there, right? That maintains the pressure. Right? Same thing for blood volume. When your blood volume decreases, maybe you sweat too much or hemorrhage or something like that, your blood pressure is going to drop. And the way that your body brings your blood pressure back up in the long term is to resorb salt, and that helps you retain water in your body, and that maintains blood pressure. All right, but that doesn't have anything to do with the nervous system. This is due to the endocrine system. So control of blood pressure as a result of action of aldosterone is what? Is that fast-acting or slow-acting? Right? Is it long-lasting or short-lasting? It is, yeah, it is slow-acting, but it lasts for a long period of time. Okay, so that's aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. Another class are what we call glucocorticoids, and glucocorticoids help regulate not sodium and potassium levels in your body, but glucose metabolism. And that's why we call it a glucocorticoid. And glucose is an important energy molecule, right? And cortisol, because it maintains or helps maintain glucose concentration in the blood, it's used to adapt to stressful situations. Or deal with stressful situations, because you'll need a lot of energy, right, to operate your heart and your brain and lungs and skeletal muscle, and that's what glucocorticoids are good for. They all come from the adrenal cortex. The other thing you might notice is this word right here, corticoid. It means that this hormone is based on cholesterol, which is a fatty material, it's a lipid, so aldosterone and cortisol are just modifications of cholesterol, as is progesterone and testosterone and estrogen, sort of all in the same class of hormones, or lipid hormones. Okay, so the cortex, you can see, has different layers, and I'm not going to ask you the different layers. The different layers are responsible for producing what? Different hormones. But these layers of the adrenal cortex still need adrenal corticotropic hormone from the pituitary gland to secrete and also to maintain itself. Okay, what else? Pineal gland. All right, the pineal gland, you get to see where that is in lab this week. Let's see, where do I have a picture of a pineal gland? I might have a picture of a pineal gland up here. Ah, nice. All right, so here is a nice sagittal view, like a mid-sagittal section of the brain, and we can see cerebellum, right, medulla, pons. Here's the pituitary, anterior, posterior pituitary, hypothalamus, and then here's the thalamus, and then right here is the pineal gland. Right, you're going to see that in the sheep brain, and then down over here are the corpora quadrigemina. All right, so it's located on the roof of the diencephalon, and it's shaped like a pine cone. It secretes melatonin. And melatonin is a hormone that helps your body adjust and regulate rhythmic things in your body, like day-night cycles. We call that circadian rhythms. Right, so it helps maybe with adjusting sleep cycles so that you can sleep properly. So it's a gland that helps time things. It's used for timing different things in your body. Another event that's related to timing is the onset of puberty. And we also think that the pineal body regulates when somebody goes through puberty. Because as we get older, that pineal gland starts to atrophy and we stop secreting, or the amount of melatonin that is secreted, it diminishes, and we think that melatonin inhibits adolescence, right, or puberty. And so when those levels decrease, that's when somebody goes through puberty into adulthood. And we think that has to do with the pineal gland. Okay, the pancreas. Pancreas is right here in the abdominal cavity, and the pancreas has some digestive functions, right? So it does secrete some digestive enzymes through a duct into the intestine, so it has an exocrine function, but it also secretes things into the blood, some signaling compounds in the blood, so it also has an endocrine function. And the endocrine cells, right there, what do you have to know? Yeah, you do have to know these two types, alpha cells and beta cells inside the pancreas. Okay, the beta cells secrete insulin, and probably you've heard of insulin before because it helps regulate blood glucose levels. And insulin decreases blood glucose concentration. So when you're in a fed state, your blood glucose concentration increases, and insulin is released from the pancreas, and insulin works like a passport that allows cells to take glucose up from the blood. And when glucose leaves the blood to go inside cells, what happens to the concentration of glucose in the blood? It goes down, right? So that's why we say insulin decreases blood glucose concentration. But okay, just like calcium, it's very important to maintain the proper level of glucose in the blood. So under what kind of control do you think plasma or blood glucose concentration, how should it be regulated? Two ways, antagonistic mechanism, some people are thinking, and that is exactly right. The pancreas not only secretes insulin when blood glucose is high, but it secretes another hormone called glucagon. And maybe you've never heard of glucagon, but you can probably get a sense of what it does. It works opposite to insulin, so it increases blood glucose. For instance, when you're in a fasted state, when you wake up first thing in the morning, your blood glucose hasn't dropped very much because glucagon from the pancreas has been released, and it goes to the liver and it tells the liver to secrete glucose into the blood, maintaining blood glucose concentration. All right, so insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other, but as a result, right, your body has precise control and balance over blood glucose levels, no matter if you're in a fasted state or in a fed state, whether you've eaten something or if you're fasting. It really doesn't matter. Okay, the thymus gland, located right here in the mediastinum, and it's important for immune response, which means that it fights infections. There's a certain kind of cell that is produced by bone marrow, and then it's transported to the thymus, and there it matures into a mature infection-fighting cell called a T lymphocyte. And one of the jobs of a T lymphocyte is that they are contact killers. They can be released from the thymus back into the blood, and when they bump into a bacteria, right, they actually have to touch that bacteria, they'll grab hold of it and then break the bacterium apart. Right, they will, what we say, lyse the bacteria. So a T cell is a contact killer. And there's different ways that your body can kill bacteria through different mechanisms, but it doesn't necessarily involve the thymus gland or the T lymphocytes. Okay, then the gonads. Okay, we talked about gonads, showed you where they are. I think everybody knows where the gonads are. Main source of sex steroids or hormones. Okay, they're the primary reproductive organs in our body. You have testes and ovaries. And the male, of course, have testes. And we're going to look at these gonads in a lot of detail when we get to the last chapter. But here is just a little introduction to them. There are compartments within the testes and that contain tubules. And then there are spaces in between these tubules that contain cells that we call interstitial cells. In between the little tubules, the tubules produce sperm, and those interstitial cells secrete testosterone. A general term for testosterone is androgen. Right. And so then androgens or testosterone have a number of functions in the body, right? It promotes the formation of sperm, the production of sperm, number one, and it helps maintain secondary sex characteristics. So what are some things that make males different from females? Okay, hair, that's right. Males have more hair, coarser hair all over their body due to testosterone. Testosterone also inhibits or delays the onset of puberty. And that just means that males then have a little bit longer period of time to grow. So males within a family typically are a little bit bigger compared to females because they reach puberty at an older age, which then also means that their larynx gets bigger, right? And as the larynx gets bigger, their voice gets lower compared to females, right? So that's what we call a secondary sex characteristic. Okay, some other secondary sex characteristics would be, for instance, like maintaining and also promoting the growth of a penis, for instance. So testosterone is also necessary for that. All right, in the female, right, there are two sex hormones. Estrogen maintains the secondary sex characteristics of a female, which means like what? Development of mammary glands, okay? And progesterone, right, is important. Males don't have a counterpart to progesterone, but let's look at this term a little bit. I see in this word, in this hormone progesterone, I see a word that says gestation. What does gestation mean? Gestation is that period of time when somebody is pregnant, right? And so that means that the embryo is growing and developing and then becomes a fetus and continues to grow. That's gestation. Progesterone is a hormone that maintains pregnancy. So it used to be called progestational hormone. And so when progesterone levels are high within a female, then we have a tendency to think that that female is pregnant. Okay? But also, progesterone does get to high levels during the last part of the menstrual cycle, and it's important for maintaining or prepares the uterus for pregnancy. So it's also important for preparing the uterus for pregnancy, and then if pregnancy does develop, then it stays at a high concentration until parturition, and then it decreases. All right, so that's it for endocrine system. So probably one of the most important things that I would like for you to not forget in this endocrine chapter, of course, the antagonistic control of calcium levels and glucose levels in your blood, those hormones are important. But I want you to know for sure the anatomy of the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. All right, so don't forget about the anterior pituitary and what hormones it secretes, and the posterior pituitary, what hormones it secretes, and how those hormones are controlled by the hypothalamus, that special blood supply and that special tract that come down from the hypothalamus. Okay. All right, any questions on endocrine chapter? Questions on endocrine? All right, so that's it for the upcoming test, which is when? A week from today. Thank you. All right, so that takes us to the next chapter, which is heart. Let me just flip through these slides and see if there's anything else I wanted to say about this. Not really. 35 weeks. Okay. Do you have anything in the study guide on this chapter? I don't know if I put a study guide together for this chapter. there's no exam figures, no labeling stuff, then the answer is no, then I won't put any of these on the test for you to label. Okay, so end of chapter questions, maybe there's some online questions. But if there are no exam figures, then there are no exam figures. There is one? Oh, it's in a separate one. Oh, okay. Okay, maybe we should look at Blackboard and take a look at that. Do I have Blackboard open? I don't. Somebody else had a question about Blackboard. Who else had a question about Blackboard? What was it? Same question. Let's look. All right, so what should pop up is that announcement of where you find the answer keys to end of chapter questions. And study guides. Where on earth do we find study guides? It's under documents. Okay. Study guides. I see study guides. So it's going to be in here. All right. Endocrine chapter. Right here. All right, so, where was that question at? So, these are the objectives, read those pages, exam figures. Oh yeah, 17, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8. Which one is this? This is 4. Yeah, this is real important anatomy for you to know. Okay, so that is. And some end of chapter questions as well, 1 through 4 and 6 through 11. Ah, okay, no pre-lecture reading assignment? Is that what you're... Oh, okay, there's not a module.
Yeah.
That's right, there's no module. You just have the study guide. I see what you're saying. There's no, like, drag and drop exercises and things like that. Yeah, I didn't know where to put it in without making it a week too long. So, anything in that study guide? Anything in the study guide? Yep. Okay. All right. So let's go on to the heart, which is this chapter right here. Well, you probably know a little bit about the heart, maybe a little bit more than endocrine system. All right. So... here is your heart chapter, and maybe one of the most important illustrations in the heart chapter is this thing right here, right? And we're going to focus on the heart, but we also want to learn something about the vascular system that's attached to the heart, right? And when we look at the heart right here, this is strange because this is maybe the first time we're going to step away from symmetry. Usually in our body so far, if you have a radius bone on one side of the body, what do you have on the other? You have a radius bone, right? And if you have an ear on one side of the body, what do you have on the other? You have an ear on the other side, right? There's really nice bilateral symmetry. That's really not so true anymore with the heart, because you all know that your heart is mostly on one side of the body more than the other. Where does it exist on? What side? It's more on the left than on the right. So when we look at the heart, we can kind of think of it as a triangle, or in three dimensions, a pyramid. And the tip down over here of the heart, we can consider this the tip of a pyramid or the tip of a triangle. And does anybody know from mathematics what do we call that tip of a triangle or the tip of a pyramid? That is the apex, right? The highest point, that's an apex. So this tip right here is the apex. And then what a pyramid sits on is the base. So the base is the widest part of the heart, and the apex is the pointy end. It's just what flipped upside down. But it's more than that. As you go from, okay, base to apex, the heart is angulated. It moves which way? It moves over to the left. All right, so I have to show you that. We call this a biaxial tilt. So let's consider my hand, my heart. Okay, and here's the apex, the pointy end, and the base, the wide end over here. Of course, it's not in your body like that. It's like this, right? All right, and it's sort of right on midline, but as you go from base to apex, it's tilted. And which way is it tilted? To the left, like that. Okay, so that's one way it's tilted, but it's also tilted another way. As you go from base to apex, not only is it tilted to the left, it's also tilted anteriorly, like this. So the apex is actually right up against the wall of the thorax. Okay, so that's what we call the biaxial tilt. And when your heart beats, it's actually a pretty violent contraction. When it beats, it pounds like that. And the apex of the heart actually pounds up against the chest wall. That's called the PMI, or point of maximal impulse. And you can palpate that, right? Kind of underneath your pectoralis muscle, right? You can find that point of maximal impulse. And that might be handy because in all of us, our hearts are in a little bit different location. But if you want to find it more precisely on everybody, what can you do without opening somebody's chest? You can just feel where their PMI is, and then you pretty much know where the heart is, for maybe imaging studies, or if you're putting on special electrodes for electrocardiogram, okay, you know where somebody's heart is. All right, so here is the base, here is the apex of the heart. And important, we see that the heart has some spaces inside of it, has some chambers. And what do we call chambers inside the brain that are filled with cerebrospinal fluid? Those are ventricles, right? So there are actually four chambers inside the heart. The two inferior chambers are what we call ventricles, just like what's in the brain. But there are two superior chambers here and here. And these are what we call atria. So one question that I might ask you is, how many chambers does the heart have? And you're going to say four, right? Two atria and two ventricles. Atria is superior to the ventricles. The other thing that you notice on this slide is, what about the thickness of the wall of the ventricle compared to the atria? Which one is thicker? Can you tell on this illustration? The ventricles are thicker, which means that it is a stronger muscle. It develops more pressure. The atria only have to pump blood into the ventricles, which is a very short distance. But look at this ventricle here. Where does it have to pump blood? Through the whole body, right? And so that takes a lot more pressure, and so this muscle has to be a lot stronger. We can also compare the thickness of the ventricular walls. Look at the thickness of the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle. Which, can you tell which one is thicker, or do they look the same? The left looks like it's thicker. It's stronger than the right, because let's look at where the right ventricle pumps blood. It only pumps blood through the lungs, which is a much shorter distance than everywhere in your body. So the right ventricle can be a lot weaker. All right, so you notice that the heart has two sides when you look at this diagram, nicely color-coded. And the two sides are what? Left and right. Which means also that there are two circulations that the heart pumps blood through. Right? The left ventricle pumps blood everywhere in your body. We call that the systemic circulation. The right ventricle pumps blood just through the lungs, and we call that the pulmonary circulation. Right? So the heart really isn't one pump. It's two pumps that have been put together, right? And they're pumping blood in different locations. All right, what else do I see on this nice illustration? Well, this blood over here, right, I see an arrow pointing to the heart. That means that it's a certain kind of blood vessel. When blood is returning to the heart via a vessel, it has a special name. We're going to call that a vein. Right? So that's the definition of a vein. It returns blood to the heart. And here is another vessel that is returning blood to the heart. Here is another vein. But what can you tell me? Is there a difference between this vein over here? This is the pulmonary. Vena cava, right? So the vena cava. Can you tell me a difference between a vena cava, which is a vein bringing blood to the heart, compared to these pulmonary veins? Do you see a difference on this slide? Ah, you saw it. Okay, so one is red and the other is blue. And that just means that you can't tell what's a vein, or the other one, an artery, whether it has oxygen or no oxygen, or low oxygen. What determines whether something is a vein or not is what? Just the direction of blood flow. If it's to the heart, it's a vein. If it's away from the heart, it's an artery. So here we have something that's blue, all right, which means it's low in oxygen. Is this thing here an artery or a vein? And why? It's low in oxygen, but it is still an artery because why? It's taking blood away from the heart. Right? The only difference is that this artery right here is in the pulmonary circulation. This one right here that's red is in the systemic circulation. So the other thing that this slide shows is that the two circulations work kind of what opposite to each other, right? In the systemic circulation, arteries are relatively high in oxygen, but in the pulmonary circulation, arteries are relatively low. But that makes sense because where is blood going in a pulmonary artery? It's going to the lungs, and in the lungs, that's where blood picks up oxygen and releases CO2, right? And after it picks up oxygen, it returns to the heart via this pulmonary vein, right? So you can have veins in your body that are high in oxygen if they belong to the pulmonary circulation. All right, so that could be, here's your little answer key. Okay, so that can be a little bit confusing. So I see two sides of the heart, I see two circulations, I see all these chambers, right? And so these ventricles produce pressure to pump blood, right? And we see these arrows are going through the heart in one direction, right? They're not bidirectional arrows. That's very important. So blood goes from an atrium into a ventricle. Blood goes from an atrium into a ventricle. Doesn't matter if it's the right side of the heart or the left side, right? So what prevents blood from going backwards from a ventricle into an atrium? I see some flaps right here, and I see some flaps right here. Those are valves. They open up when the atria contract to pump blood into the ventricles, but when the ventricles contract, these little flaps slam closed, and they make noise, and blood can only leave these great vessels, right, the great arteries at the base of the heart. Can't go back into an atrium if it's a normal heart. Right, and it's very easy to hear these valves. Okay, so how many chambers does a heart have? Four. How many valves does a heart have? I've shown you two, okay, but it's the exact same number as the number of chambers. There are four. All right, so there is a valve between an atrium and a ventricle on both sides, right, so that's two. But there's also a valve between the ventricle and the artery that it's pumping blood into, because we don't want blood from this artery to go back into the heart, because then the heart is wasting all of that energy that it's using to pump blood into an artery if it just comes right back. So here is another valve. We call this the pulmonary valve because it's at the base of the pulmonary artery. And then this one right here, which you can just barely see, this is the aortic valve. And that's the valve between the aorta and the left ventricle. All right, so this slide has a lot of information on it. You see the right and left side, you see the two circulations, you see all the chambers, you see how veins and arteries are defined, and also which ones are oxygenated, deoxygenated, and you see all four valves. Okay, I didn't talk about these. Let's go back and talk about these. Between the atria and ventricle. These are what we call atrioventricular valves, right? Because we can combine terms in anatomy as long as we put an O between them, right? Atrioventricular. There's one on the right side, one on the left side. So when you look at this heart, it's like you're looking at my heart. Because what hand is this? That's my left hand, right? And so that's what you see over here. Here's the left side of the heart, and then here's the right side. So you're like looking at an anterior view of somebody's heart. This valve is very similar to the one between the left atrium and left ventricle, but there's a little bit of a difference. The one on the right side has three flaps. The one on the left side only has two flaps, and so that's how they get their name. This is what we call the tricuspid valve because it has three flaps. This one over here that has two is called the bicuspid valve. So you have tricuspid on the right, bicuspid on the left, and the left also has another name besides bicuspid. It's called the mitral valve. Mitral valve and bicuspid are the same valve, and people might even use those two terms in the same sentence, but they're just talking about the same valve, bicuspid and bicuspid and mitral valve are exactly the same. But nonetheless, they are what? They are atrioventricular valves. So how can you remember that the tricuspid is over here and the bicuspid is over here? Because of that funny little saying, you should try before you buy. Right? So as you look at this diagram, you get the tricuspid and then the bicuspid or mitral valve. Okay, so so whenever we talk about the heart, you should always be, or even anything about the vascular system, you should be thinking of this diagram, right? Okay, because it shows important patterns of circulation, the chambers of the heart, the valves of the heart. All right, so now you know how many chambers does the heart have? And how many valves does the heart have? It has four as well. Okay. Yeah. I think this is 19. It's 19 in your book. This right here? This is for 19 as well. Okay. They must have renumbered the chapters. What they did is they slipped in the endocrine chapter and made it chapter 17. So when they added chapter 17, then I guess all my notes really should have one more chapter added to it. So here is 19, yeah, so, and I think that's what happened to the answer keys for the end of chapter questions too. When they added that chapter, they didn't go and revise the end of chapter questions in the appendix B. All right, so we talked about the chambers, right? We got right atrium, right ventricle, left atrium, left ventricle. The right side is for the pulmonary circulation. The left side is for the systemic circulation. Which circulation is longer? Which circulation is bigger? Pulmonary or systemic? Systemic, that's right. And so that means that you need higher pressure to get blood to go through that whole circulation. So the left side of the heart has to be stronger as a result. And you can see that in the thickness of the wall. Another name for heart is myocardium. Okay, so sometimes we use that term, right? There are separations between the chambers, and what do you call that thing that separates your two nostrils from each other? A septum, right? And so there are septa that separate the two atria and the two ventricles, so one is an atrial septum, the other is a ventricular septum. Okay, let's look at some layers of the heart. Layers are always really important. And to show you layers, to get you started with layers, let's look at this view. This is the labeling figure for lab next time. Right, so you should be really familiar with this figure right here. But you can see the two chambers. You can see all the valves very nicely. Here's the right side of the heart. Here's the left side. All right, but let's think of layers. I see three layers that are named. The outermost layer on top of the heart. Most superficial layer, kind of named after that superficial layer on your integument. What's that? Well, yeah, what do you call that most superficial layer on your integument? Is the, epithelium, epidermis. Okay, that's the epidermis. All right, but epi is the key term. So the layer that's most superficial on the heart is called the epicardium, right? And you know this is heart because anytime you hear cardium or myocardium, you should think of the heart, right? Just like osteo or whatever. Pulmonary, when you hear pulmonary, you should think of lungs, for instance. All right, so epicardium, most superficial layer. The next layer is the thickest, and that's made up of muscle, and that's called the myocardium. And then the third layer, which lines every surface on the inside of the heart, it's not a very thick layer, but it follows every little curvature on the inside of the heart. We call that the endocardium. And the endocardium also makes up valves that I see right here. Here's the tricuspid, here's the bicuspid, here's the pulmonary, and here's the aortic valve. It makes up these valves. And the endocardium is kind of special because it's super slippery and super smooth. And that's very important because, you know, blood is a connective tissue. It's kind of a strange connective tissue because it's a fluid. So it can flow from one place to another. But if it ever stands still for very long, or if it bumps into something sharp, guess what happens to that fluid? It can turn into a solid, all right? So it clots, it forms a clot. So that endocardium is very special so that the heart doesn't form clots, because then those clots could go into the aorta and then to the brain, cause a stroke, right? Or maybe back to the heart, cause a heart attack. So that endocardium and the valves, right, have to be really smooth to prevent clotting of blood. All right, so here are the three layers: epicardium, myocardium, endocardium. All right, but the heart is in its own chamber, right? What cavity is the heart in? It's in the thoracic cavity, right? But it's also in a subcavity, which is the mediastinum. And then there's even a subcavity to the mediastinum, which is the pericardial cavity, right? So there's a special membrane around the whole heart, which holds the heart up, suspends the heart, and that's called the pericardium. So let's look at the pericardium. What, now that we know these three layers. All right, so where is the pericardium at? All right, so let's look at this part of the heart. We're going to look up at by an atrium. So the muscle wall is not going to be really thick, but still we can see it. Right, and let's look at the layers. What was the layer that lines everything inside the heart? That is the endocardium. So far, so good. The next layer, the next superficial one that contains contractile or muscle tissue, that's the myocardium. And then what's right on the surface of the heart? The epicardium. All right. But now let's follow this epicardium around. All right, we follow the epicardium around. We get to the pulmonary trunk, and then it folds back on itself. Right. And then there's a little space in here. This is what we call a serous membrane. And can you remember the two kinds of, or the different divisions of the serous membrane? Right. There are two basic kinds of membranes. You've got mucous membranes and serous membranes. Mucous membranes line a cavity that's open to the outside world, like your nasal cavity, right? Oral cavity, reproductive tract, digestive tract, open to the outside world, so that's lined with the mucous membrane, but the pericardium is not open to the outside world. So it's surrounded by a serous membrane, right? So a serous membrane has got three parts. The part that's right on the organ itself is called what? The visceral part of the serous membrane, okay? And the part that's maybe lining the body wall or superficial to this visceral organ, this is what we call the parietal serous membrane. And what's between the parietal and visceral serous membrane is the serous cavity with serous fluid. But since we're talking about the pericardial cavity, all right, or the pericardium, we don't just call this the serous cavity, we call this the pericardial cavity, filled with serous fluid. Right? And the epicardium that we talked about actually becomes what? The visceral pericardium, because it's also part of the serous membrane. And when it folds back like this, right here I can see the parietal layer of the pericardium. Right, so the pericardium has a parietal division, right, a visceral division, and serous fluid in between. But that's not enough to hold the heart in position. There's even a fibrous capsule that surrounds the whole heart, and that's what we call the fibrous pericardium. All right, so this is a little bit more complicated than maybe what you were expecting, but start with these three layers right here: endocardium, myocardium, and epicardium. But if you think in terms, if you're thinking of the heart, that's fine, but if you're thinking in terms of the serous membrane that surrounds the heart, then this epicardium really becomes what? The visceral pericardium, and it folds back on itself, then this becomes the parietal pericardium, and that space is what? The pericardial cavity. I think we talked about this maybe in chapter 1 or chapter 2. You can go back and review those chapters. So these membranes can become infected, can become inflamed, maybe not even infected, but inflamed. And what do we call an inflammation of the pericardial cavity? Pericarditis. Okay. And normally, the pericardial cavity is maybe about a centimeter or less than a centimeter thick. It shouldn't be very, very thick. But when it gets inflamed, all right, then this starts to fill up with fluid. The pericardial cavity fills up with fluid. And that's a sure sign of pericarditis. And that's very dangerous. Okay, because what's the job of the heart once again? It pumps blood. All right, but in order for the heart to pump blood, where does blood have to go? It has to come from a vein into the heart. The heart has to fill up with blood before it can pump blood. But if the pericardial cavity is filled up with fluid, guess what? Then the heart can't relax and expand and receive blood from your circulation. So the heart might contract just fine, but if blood isn't flowing into it because the pericardium is filled with fluid, then blood is not going to be pumped. And so that fluid has to be dealt with, the infection has to be dealt with, and sooner the better. So one good way to get rid of this fluid in the pericardial cavity would be to just jab a needle in there and suck it out. Okay? And usually somebody thanks you when that happens because they feel much better. Okay, so that's why all of these membranes and layers are very important for you to know. Right, so you got that pericardial fluid. All right, the four valves we talked about so far. Right, the right side, don't forget, is pulmonary circulation. You got the tricuspid over there, and the right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary artery. So there you have the pulmonary semilunar valve, right at the base of the pulmonary artery, and then at the on the other side of the heart, at the base of the aorta, you have the aortic semilunar valve. Okay. Circulation through the heart. You know, that's described pretty well on this slide right here. All right. But I do want you to know something, okay, about circulation through the heart. So I'm going to leave this on the board, and I think this is a pre-lecture reading assignment, and it's important, it might even be a test question in the study guide, and that is, let's trace a drop of blood through the whole circulation and through the whole heart. All right, so we're going to put a marker someplace on this figure right here and trace that blood where it goes through all of these different structures, and we also want to look at what the state of the blood is in each of these different locations. So where should we put this marker first? Should we put it in the right atrium, left atrium? Somebody said right atrium. So we're going to start right here. Okay, that's a good place to start. So we have blood in the right atrium. I'm going to abbreviate that, but RA for right atrium. Maybe I'll turn a light on so you can see that. All right, right atrium. What's the state of blood in the right atrium? It just so happens I'm using a blue marker. Okay, and I would say low in oxygen. They still have some oxygen, so I don't want to say no oxygen to be precise. I'm just going to say what? Low. Low oxygen. And also that means what? High CO2, which is an excretory product of our metabolism. All right, where does blood go after the right atrium? It goes to the right ventricle, but it's got to pass something first. The tricuspid valve, right? So write down tricuspid. And what kind of valve is it? It's an atrioventricular valve. So I'm going to put AV, right? Tricuspid is an atrioventricular valve. You could actually say tricuspid atrioventricular valve if you're talking to somebody that doesn't know a whole lot about the heart. All right, what's the state of blood as it passes the tricuspid valve? Low oxygen. Okay, and then where does it go? Into the right ventricle. What's the state of blood in the right ventricle? Low oxygen, same thing for CO2, right? High in CO2. From the right ventricle, where does that blood go? It's gonna want to go to the lungs. Okay, how does it get to the lungs? It's got to get into the pulmonary artery. Remember, an artery is a vessel that takes blood away from the heart, and so that's an artery. It's taking blood away from the heart to the lungs, but it's got to pass something first before it gets into the pulmonary artery, and that is another valve. All right, so here's the first valve. Second valve is going to be the pulmonary, and it's called a semilunar valve. I'll put that down. Pulmonary semilunar valve. And what's the state of oxygen as it passes the pulmonary semilunar valve? It's low oxygen still. Okay. All right. Then it gets into the pulmonary artery, as you suggested before. I like that. Pulmonary artery. So there's a pulmonary artery that goes to the right lung and the left lung, so there's a right and left pulmonary artery. But before then, there's just one artery coming off the base of the heart. Sometimes we call that the pulmonary artery, sometimes we call that the pulmonary trunk before it splits into two. So pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery you can use. What's the state of oxygen here in the pulmonary artery? Low, right? So again, low in oxygen. After the pulmonary artery, where does it go? It goes in the lungs. And there's a special kind of blood vessel I see on this diagram, and it's even labeled on this diagram. It has all these branches to it. So I'm going to put pulmonary capillary. And pulmonary capillary, you know, is in the lungs. Capillaries have a special function. They allow for exchange. They're really thin. Things can enter or leave the blood only in a capillary, not in an artery or a vein. So pulmonary capillary, I want you to know that it is important for exchange. All right, so what is happening with exchange? Okay, O2 goes in and CO2 goes out. That's what we mean by exchange in the lungs. All right, so then after the pulmonary capillaries, where does it go? Pulmonary vein, because it's taking blood back to the heart, and any vessel that brings blood back to the heart is a vein by definition. All right, so here is a pulmonary vein. All right, bringing blood back to the heart. Now, what about oxygen in this vein, high or low? Oxygen in this vein. Are you sure? High in a vein? You're going to say yes, because it's the pulmonary circulation. All right, don't get tricked with that. So in the pulmonary vein, it is now high in oxygen. And what about CO2? Low in CO2. Okay. When do we end? 12:05? I forget when class. When is class over? Does anybody know? Something. All right, so it's over pretty much right about now. So next time we got to finish this up. Oh, there won't be a next time. Because guess what next time is? It's going to be a test, all right, but this stuff won't be on the test, right? Just the endocrine chapter is the last one. So a week and a half from today, we'll finish this diagram up. But you might want to look at it yourself, see if you can finish this up.